Good morning, everyone. I will call this meeting of the Civil Law and Data Practices meeting or committee to order. The first order of business is approval of the minutes of April 25th. Representative Johnson has reviewed the minutes and moves those minutes. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. This morning we are here to take up House File 3925. The only section of this bill that applies to our committee is on page 9 at the bottom. Section 6, it begins on page 9.33. And that will be the only, I would ask testifiers to keep your comments to that section, and we can move through this. With that, Representative Hackbarth, I will move House File 3925 and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the IRRB reform bill. The reason we're here today is because the new commission would be subject to 13D, and we want to make that open to the public. And that's why we're here, Madam Chair.
Very well. Before we get started with a number of questions, I'd like to ask if there's anybody in the audience that wishes to testify to this section of the bill. Representative Ansels, come on forward. Welcome to the Civil Law Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead with your testimony.
To begin with, Madam Chair, I am the current chair of the IRRR board, which consists of 9 people, 5 members of the Minnesota Senate, and 4 members of the Minnesota House of Representatives. I'm joined here this morning with one of my colleagues who's also on the board, Representative Eklund, and Representative Metza and Representative Moline are also members of this board. For the record, Madam Chair, I want the committee to know that the people of the Iron Range, who we represent, and my colleagues on the IRRR board, and Commissioner Phillips and the executive branch are all in opposition in principle to the Hackbarth legislation, House File 3925. That's my first point. My second point is, of course, the IRRR board proceedings has always been subject to the open meeting law. And quite frankly, as far as transparency is concerned, Madam Chair, you and I worked on some transparency and openness in government legislation in 2012, where we repealed a provision that we both found onerous to the public's right to know. Third point is we support openness in government. We always have, and we support any provisions which allow the public to participate in public meetings as they should. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Representative Ansels. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this section of the bill?
Not seeing anyone.
Here I am standing.
We have a special guest here this morning, a former member. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tom Rukavina. I used to be somebody. I'm a nobody now, but I used to be a state representative for 26 years, and for 26 years I sat on the IRRB board, and I can honestly say that in those 26 years I never ever recall anything not being open to the public. But Madam Chair, you know, I happen to be here today. I wasn't able to get here last week. And so I was hoping you'd just let me drift off a little bit off of civil law, if you would be so kind.
Can you make it in 3 minutes?
I can make it in less than 3 minutes.
All right.
Yes, I can.
Go ahead.
Members, I represented for 26 years the Quad Cities of Virginia, Eveleth, Gilbert, and Mountain Iron, where about every year 55 to 60% of the taconite tax is produced, because that's where 55 to 60% of the ore is produced every year. And in fact, this year, because we have two mines shut down, Mintac, which is the largest iron ore plant in the mine in the United States of America, will produce 16 million tons of ore. They'll mine about 35 tons of crude ore to get that 16 million tons of pellets. And so, you know, the IRRB gets part of that. It's a local property tax. In lieu of a regular property tax, the production tax is a local property tax based on the mineral wealth of the Iron Range. And the mineral wealth of the Iron Range has just done wonders for this state. In fact, every year in the Permanent School Trust, every student, I think, that what are there, people on the Education Committee can help me, about 850,000 students when I left. Is there a little more now? Representative Hoppe, you probably know more than anybody, being that you got some whiskers here too. I think about 850,000 students that get $30 a head. So, you know, that $25 million a year comes from the mineral wealth of the range, and then at the University of Minnesota, their permanent university fund is also almost all from taconite and natural ore royalties, and the endowed chairs bring in about $600 to $700 million a year into the Twin Cities economy. And the largest scholarship at the University of Minnesota is now the Iron Range Scholarship, which goes to about one out of every five students that graduate from a Minnesota high school. It's about $3.5 to $4 million a year. So I'm asking Representative Hackbarth to just let the people of the range, who work very hard all the time, and you know, Representative Hackbarth and I got along good when we were here. We voted on a lot of things together. To just let the people of the range keep a little bit of their money for future years. You know, we probably have 500 years of taconite left that actually could be gotten at. We have mineral wealth in copper and nickel and zinc and gold and platinum that we're blessed with, that I hope soon we can get one mine operating. But we've done a lot for this state, and you know, I know that IRRB has received criticism many times over the years in my 26 years, but I do want, and I like Mr. Nobles, him and I are good friends, you know, Jim, but he's not correct. I mean, maybe he'll emphasize it. I just want to tell you folks this. Almost all the money at the IRRB, and there are a couple of funds, and I plead guilty on one of them, a higher ed fund, that don't come back to the governor. But 95% of the money at the IRRB is vetoed and could be pocket vetoed by the commissioner. As far as I'm concerned, there is no constitutional issue. And I can tell you in all honesty, after representing the people of the range for 26 years and now being a commissioner, where two of the mines are located in my district, in my St. Louis County Commissioner's District, that the people of the Iron Range overwhelmingly support the IRRB and its makeup, and the fact that legislators from the area sit there and deal with taxes that are local property taxes. I don't know of any other state agency like it. It's unique. It was initially created by Governor Harold Sasson, a forward-thinking Republican, and there are a lot of them, Representative Scott. But then it was changed in 1977. The funding source was not a general occupation tax on iron ore. It was the local property tax that funded it. So I don't support Representative Hackbarth's bill, but I do support openness, and I always have in government, and everything is open up there, and I just appreciate your consideration, and I thank you very much for letting me say a few words here today. So nice to see all of you again that were here when I was here, and for those of you that I don't know, I look forward to meeting you personally if you want to talk about this issue. Well, Representative Pinto, how you doing? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Former Representative Rukavina. It's always good to see you.
And if there were any questions, I'd stand for them. Otherwise, I'll get out of
here. Does anyone
have
any questions quickly for Representative Rukavina? Wow, people are speechless.
Back off the temptation.
Yeah. I'm waiting for it. I'm begging.
Madam Chair,
Representative Flesch.
When you ask him a question, it backfires, so I'm not going to walk into that trap.
Very good. Thank you for being here. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I just wanted to say that when you were state rep, I was only here a few years with you, that your history lessons about the Minnesota legislature and the Iron Range and what's happened in the past did a great deal to help educate me on our state and especially the Iron Range area. So
thank
I thank you for that.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And so I'm not BSing you today. Everything I said was true.
Madam Chair.
In light of the fact that we're in the middle of a capital renovation, and former Representative Rukavina used to always remind us that it was the Iron Range revenue that built the original capital. So I want to know where all that money is now for us to build the capital over there this time. What happened?
Well, we've put it into those trust accounts that keep giving. And we're like the Energizer rabbit. We just keep giving and giving and giving. Like I mentioned to you, $25 million a year for St. Paul School District. About a million and a quarter. About $1.25 million for Anoka Hennepin, and another $1.25 million for Minneapolis. And you know, when the environmental community says, well, a copper nickel mine, and you know, it's not going to produce that much money. No. Where I come from, $1.25 million is still a little bit of money.
Quite a bit of money.
So that's what I was talking about with the question back.
And Butler Brothers. Butler Brothers had a mine, and Butler Brothers built the original capital, and they had Butler Brothers, or Butler Taconite, which was in Representative Ansel's district that closed down about 20 years ago, Representative Ansel's, maybe 20, 25 years ago. And so when they had the 200th anniversary of the state, and Governor Pawlenty was over there, and old Mr. Butler, who was still in 2002, 150th anniversary, old Mr. Butler was still there, and he said, we've never forgotten, Mr. Rukavina, the contribution of the Iron Range to our state of Minnesota.
Representative Blesch, follow up?
No, I won't do it. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen, I think, had something else.
Yeah, just one more comment. Would you please, while you're down here, talk to the governor and get PolyMet and Twin Metals going up there, okay? And drill in an environmentally responsible way that helps all citizens, including the Iron Range.
Representative Grunhagen, we have been told on the range by many, many people, including the governor, to let the science work, and the science worked. And the environmental impact statement says that we can mine, and we can mine cleanly and environmentally sound. And folks, it's 134 years this year since we took out the first iron ore out of Sedan Mine. And everybody from down here thinks we live in the wilderness. So we've been mining for 134 years continuously, and we still have our wilderness up there. We will do it right, we will do it responsibly, and we will continue to contribute to all those different funds I mentioned when the other mineral wealth of this state starts coming on the ground.
I appreciate those comments. And Representative Pinto, do you have something?
I do, actually. Madam Chair, I actually have a serious, actually have a question about the provision under discussion for the committee. Maybe this is both the author and the testifier, Representative Rukavina.
Go ahead.
So the provision we're looking at says that the commission shall essentially meet throughout various regions of the state during the biennium. And as I understand it, I mean, these are payments being made by companies being made in lieu of property taxes that local governments would be receiving. So it feels like it's something that's pretty focused on that particular region of the state. So I'm wondering for the author, any comment from Representative Rukavina as to sort of what the relevance is for this commission to be meeting all these regions of the state, recognizing that these are funds that are generated in a particular part of the state and really in lieu of property taxes that they would have been paying.
To the bill's author, Representative Hackbar.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, this is never, despite what some people might be saying, this is not meant to be stealing the money from the IRRRB or from the Iron Range and disperse it throughout the state or other areas of the state at all. This bill is about reform and transparency and accountability. That's what this is all about. And if you've looked at the legislative auditor's report at all, those are some of the things that we want to address. And when we keep talking about property taxes and those kinds of things, there are a number of accounts, and we're not looking or dealing with any of the accounts that go to the local units of government, the schools, any of those things. It's the account that has the discretionary spending in it, where there's some decisions being made that aren't followed up upon. And that's why we're here with this bill today, is some of the discretionary spending that's taking place. And those are the kinds of things that we want to have more transparency about. How are we spending that money? Where are the jobs that were supposed to be created by spending this money or giving out this grant or giving out this loan? Where are those jobs? There's no accountability for that, and there's no follow-up to see if those jobs have been retained.
Would you like to hear from Representative Rukavina?
I would.
All right.
Madam
Go ahead.
Chair, Representative Pinto. I would have to differ a little bit with Representative Hackbar's statement, because the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board is also, and all those discretionary funds are also funded by the local tax. So it would be comparable to having the St. Paul City Council or the St. Paul School District, you know, hold meetings in Virginia or Hibbing or Le Sueur or wherever, because it is local taxes. And you know, there's some confusion, I think, that the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board was a state agency when Harold Stassen created it, because it got the occupation tax, which is the corporate income tax on iron ore and taconite. But in 77, it was switched around where it was funded by this local production tax, which is in lieu of property taxes. And so there's a little confusion, and I would say that we've always been open and we've always studied how many jobs were created. You know, every agency, and you see it down here, whether it's the Port Authority of St. Paul, wherever, they take credit. And whether there's a, you know, like an Arrowhead Regional Development Commission, I think there's development commissions all around the state of Minnesota that get some state funding. And when they contribute to create a job, they all kind of take credit for it. So I always used to jokingly say, and I will have to admit, that sometimes the figures get inflated because we're getting subordinate loans from the ARDC or from a different agency or maybe DEED, or and then the IRRRB, and they're all claiming that they created in the same project the same amount of jobs. So we've kept track of what we do. We keep track of our money. We're open and honest and transparent. And I would say that, you know, 90% of the people across the Iron Range of Minnesota where this money comes from are supportive of the current makeup and the current policies of the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board. And Madam Chair, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I really appreciate and thank you for letting me be here today. And I wish Representative Hackbarth luck on everything but this bill.
Representative Hackbarth, did you have a rebuttal to that?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. And some of the first legislation that I worked on when I came to the legislature was in cooperation with Representative Rukavina. And we sat at this very testimony table in the same room talking about ATV trails and snowmobile trails and snowmobile laws and things like that, and the off-highway recreational vehicle area up in Gilbert. And we were both instrumental in getting that up and running. And so I appreciate everything that Representative Rukavina and I have worked on, and I feel we've both done some good things. But I just did want to clarify that this is a state agency. It is a state agency. It does have a cabinet-level position within the governor's administration. There is a commissioner, and this is a state agency, and it's the only state agency without any legislative oversight. None whatsoever. And that's why this bill is here today.
Thank you. Any other comments from members or questions regarding this section of the bill? Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, it relates to an area squarely within the jurisdiction of Civil Law Committee, which is, in fact, what Representative Hackbarth just brought up, which I think alludes to the constitutional question, which is our purview here. And I read through this, and I honestly don't understand all the kind of big back and forth between range issues and people who are opposed to range issues, or I shouldn't put it that way, but I am wondering about the allegations for unconstitutionality of the board, and I assume it's because Representative Hackbarth said lack of oversight. Is that correct, Representative Hackbarth?
Representative Hackbarth.
Well, Madam Chair, and the constitutional issue has to do with the legislators sitting on the board and making final decisions on things that the governor maybe should be having the final decision on. And I think even the legislation that Senator Bach is bringing forward in the Senate addresses that issue. But that's the only part of anything connected with this Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. That's the only thing the Senate is addressing is the constitutional issue. And changing that and giving it back to the final say to the governor as opposed to the legislators sitting on the board. So that's the constitutional issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hackbarth, can you help me understand that? Because in my recollection of separation of powers issues and constitutional law, when something has been passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, that in large part, in most circumstances, satisfies the separation of powers issues, because the governor signed it at that time, and that's the executive action. The legislature passed it at that time. The either body concede, either one branch concede to the other branch certain functions based upon agreement, and that agreement was reached at least in the 1995 legislation. So how is it that that would make this an unconstitutional situation?
And Representative Lesch, Ms. Dewicki is in the audience, who is the one that I believe was responsible for that part of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's findings. Would you like to hear from her on that?
I would like to, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll find out.
Good morning, and welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. And if you want to go ahead and state your name for the tape and continue on with answering the question, if you would, please. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Stewicki, and I am the Director of Legal Research for the OLA. I think Legislative Auditor Nobles and I can both kind of address this. We found that there were problems both in separation of powers, but also in legislators holding another public office. Because this is a board of legislators, they are making executive branch decisions. And the big change actually happened in 1995. Before that, they were in an advisory position. And I would also say, too, the problem isn't not necessarily as much with the governor, but with the commissioner. The board has approval power over what the commissioner decides. And that's where the separation of powers problem comes into play. Did you want to add something?
Good morning, Mr. Nobles. Go ahead and state your name for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, and Representative Lesch, I don't know if you've had an opportunity, but we have a discussion, an analysis in the appendix to our report, which addresses both the separation of powers issue and the what is often referred to as the dual office holding prohibition in the Minnesota Constitution. So I would commend that to you and be happy to get back with you and address any concerns or questions you might have. We think that on the face of it, both the separation of powers provision and the dual office prohibition provision really raise questions about the constitutionality of the governance structure of the IRRB. And we also think that, for example, an opinion issued by an attorney general some time back makes it very clear that if legislators have final authority to make decisions in an executive agency, that constitutes holding another office. And that's applying what you, I'm sure, are familiar with as the McCutcheon test, which was laid out by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1974. So again, I don't know how much, Madam Chair, you want to get into the constitutional issues, but we were asked to look at this, and our conclusion was that the current governance structure is vulnerable to a constitutional challenge. We're not in a position, we're not a court. We didn't make a judgment that in fact it is unconstitutional, but we certainly think that given the language of the Constitution, certain case law, attorney general opinion, that is certainly vulnerable to a constitutional challenge on both separation of powers and dual office holding prohibition.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Otter Nobles and Ms. I'm sorry.
Dewicki.
Dewicki, thank you. And I missed that discussion at the appendix. I was looking through all this stuff, and I see it on page 66 now of the in the appendices. But I wonder if you could tell me this. Ironically, at least on this side of the table, you've got four people who've all hold executive offices outside the legislature. I no longer do because I left the city attorney's office. But I was a prosecutor. We got a prosecutor for Anoka County, prosecutor for Hennepin County, and a police officer.
Ramsey County.
What did I say?
You said Hennepin.
Hennepin. Sorry, that's bad.
Another state.
Really?
It is. Jeez. Okay. So, can you tell me, I mean, how that analysis would affect, I mean, us, really? And the reason for that is, I mean, of course, my opinion is that this is not unconstitutional unless it's challenged by someone with standing to do so. But, you know, not only back in those days did I draw a legislative salary, I also drew a salary from the city of St. Paul, and I drew money from the federal government through the National Guard Bureau, which, so, you know, triple dipping. Not very much, by the way. I say triple ladling just a little bit because they're horrible salaries. But how would that be looked at through the McCutcheon test that you
Mr. Nobles or Ms. Stwicky?
Members of the committee, I would say I'd point you to, if you have our report, it's on page 67. And that has to do with the McCutcheon test. And talking about police officers, that case was about police officers, on whether William McCutcheon and a couple of other officers who were also legislators were holding two public offices. And the court said, well, it was kind of a brief opinion, there was a test that came out of it. And the test is whether that person has independent authority under law, either alone or with others of equal authority, to determine public policy or to make a final decision not subject to the supervisory approval or disapproval of another. So if you're a police officer, you're still subject to supervisory approval of someone else.
In fact, in that case, the court held that Senator McCutcheon was not holding another office. So, again, there was this challenge, not only to Senator McCutcheon, who was an active police officer in the St. Paul Police Department, but others, and they held that, no, he was not violating that, but I think the value is that they laid forth a test of what would constitute a violation.
Go ahead, Mr. Wicke.
One other thing I mentioned about that is, you know, you bring up an interesting point, because when it comes to the members of the board, it is a little bit tricky, because in some cases, if you look through the funds, I think it might be on page 13, there are some cases where the board makes a final approval, and then there are other funds where they come back and the governor makes the final approval. So it's a little bit tricky in the sense, if you're using the McCutcheon test, in those cases maybe where the governor comes back, you could make an argument that they are not, that they are subject to the approval of someone else, and that being the governor.
Okay.
Representative
Madam Chair, and I'm wondering, because we get into that gray area if it comes back or not, and I'm thinking of my two colleagues here who are both prosecutors, who you could say they're subject to supervisory authority of their elected county attorney bosses. However, at the same time, they are officers of the court as a matter of law, and so they make independent decisions. And now you could say that that's not a matter of broad-reaching policy because it relates to specific cases. However, if they acted in consistently throughout it, you could say that those are policy matters, that they dismiss certain cases or they prosecute certain cases. Under that McCutcheon test, and we've had multiple prosecutors that have served here, is there a chance that you would say that those jobs would be violative of separation of powers in light of attorneys, especially prosecutors, being officers of the court?
Members of the committee. Are you talking separation of powers or the dual office holding?
Dual office holding.
Ms. Stwicky.
I think we would still maintain that they are still subject to supervisory approval. And, you know, my memory might be faulty, but I think, you know, one of the things that we did was we went back and looked at the transcripts of the 1857 convention of the framers of our Constitution. And I think that issue even came up, whether lawyers who are officer of the court then would be subject to the, you know, the dual office holding prohibition. And I don't think they were, because again, you know, if they were a judge, yes, because they make an independent decision. But I think as attorneys, no. I think they still are, have some upper level of supervision.
So,
Representative Lesch.
And I have to ask this, Madam Chair, thank you, but my great-great-great-grandfather was a participant in that convention. He was the delegate from Scott County, and his name's on the Constitution, and he was the first county attorney in Carver County, in fact, tried the first murder case there. So I assume that he was one who participated in this discussion as an attorney at the time. However, I have to ask, since there were two conventions and two constitutions, which one did you listen to?
The Democrat one?
Oh, you listened to both. Okay.
Pretty thorough there.
They were the transcripts. They didn't have audio, though.
Oh, yeah. But we have reenactors.
But no, that they were both. And one thing I should mention, too, is, you know, when we looked at this, our kind of environment or landscape was that our Constitution and the framers wanted a very strict separation of powers Constitution. As you know, ours goes further than the federal Constitution, because not only does it differentiate between the different branches of government, it also goes further and says a person in one branch of government should not be exercising the powers in another branch of government that are constitutional powers.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one final thing,
Mr.
and it
Noble.
Gets us away from you know, the case law and all of that, but what really is key here is, what does the statute say? And I agree with you that you know, this was enacted by the legislature and signed by the governor, but I'm sure we would all agree that there are many laws passed by the legislature and signed by a governor that are still subject to constitutional review, and many have been struck down as not being consistent and in compliance with the Constitution. So just because the legislature acts and the governor signs doesn't make it constitutional. So here is the language that I think is pivotal and actually was changed in 1995. And that is, it's one sentence: all expenditures and projects made by the commissioner shall first be submitted to the board for approval. Final approval rest with this group of legislators constituting the IRRB, the board. So that used to say that that would be submitted to the board for a recommendation, and that is the language that Senator Bach is proposing to change, and there's a companion House bill. So I would suggest to you that I personally don't think, even from the members of the current IRRB, there is a dispute as to whether or not they need to change the law to make it more consistent with the Constitution. When we briefed Senator Bach and told him about our conclusion, Senator Bach said, "We'll fix that." He had no dispute about our conclusion. He said, "Yep, in 1995 we went too far, and we ought to remain advisory. I will fix that." And that's what he's doing.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Lesch,
if I may, and I appreciate that there's been some level of political comity reached with respect to final decision by the board. I would say I don't think Senator Bach is a constitutional lawyer.
Yeah.
And I would also note that I'm probably a little bit more sensitive about this, because it just seems like this year, challenges based on allusions towards unconstitutionality have cropped up a few times in several bills that I've had, including the revenge porn bill, and revenge porn bill that is coming up in the Senate on Monday, by the way. And there was a request by certain interest groups that offenses by juveniles to this type of crime be granted an automatic diversion, where it would not, you know, go on their record. It would be diverted, wouldn't be prosecuted. And at the 11th hour, a certain assistant county attorney sent a memo through the Minnesota County Attorneys Association that stated, "You can't do that. That's unconstitutional." And I read the letter, and I said to myself, this is crazy. The suggestion of the assistant county attorney was that it's a decision of the executive branch as to whether or not to charge. And so because the legislature designated certain offenses not to be charged but to be offered diversion, that somehow that's an unconstitutional encroachment on the authority of the executive branch, which under the opinion of this particular assistant county attorney was vested solely in her at the time of charging, which in my opinion is ludicrous because it's the governor who is the other branch. It's not some random attorney somewhere that happens to work for the executive branch. So it may be that we've reached that political decision, but I just don't want to say that I think we should act immediately in reaction to suggestions of unconstitutionality, although we should strongly consider it. That's all, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list, Representative Schoen. No? Pass? Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Auditor, how many other laws have you ever recommended to the legislature are unconstitutional? What's your experience in interpreting the Constitution as it relates to state statutes?
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, it's a common function every day, actually, for us to have to interpret the law. We do compliance audits in every organization in state government, and that requires us to interpret what the law says, and we often do research, as we did in this case, by looking and listening to legislative hearings, looking for the history, as we did look at the constitutional conventions, as Ms. Dewicki said. And as to interpretations of the Constitution, I'm actually, when I go back to my office today, I will be dealing with the issue of interpretation of the legacy amendment, which we do audits as to whether or not agencies are in compliance with the constitutional provision concerning supplement, not substitute, which we have indicated in a report to the legislature is somewhat ambiguous. But as auditors, we have to interpret, we have to make a judgment, and we have sought, in that case, opinions from House counsel, from Mark Shepard. We quote him quite extensively in one of our reports. So it's unavoidable that we have to come to judgments about legal interpretation, including constitutional requirements. We also do a good deal of work in compliance with bond, the expenditure of bond funds, and so we consult with bond counsel. So it's a common part of what we do.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe if you could get me the details of how many times you've actually come to the legislature and said you believe that a statute is unconstitutional, that would be helpful for me to have when this comes forward to the floor. Members, as a lawyer who actually looks at the Constitution and who actually teaches a class on legislation, and we talk about constitutional law and how it's interpreted, it's pretty clear in the Constitution that it is the court who interprets whether or not something is constitutional. And as a legislator who's carried a statute who was determined through the court process that it was unconstitutional, and then it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, nope, it's constitutional, I have a little bit of experience in interpretation of Constitution as it relates to statutes. And so I'm just trying to make it real clear that I believe that it is your recommendation to the legislature, but ultimately the legislature decides what powers we are going to grant. And in this case, the governor granted authority by signing the bill. The governor has the ability to line item veto items from the IRRRB. And so in the event that there is a constitutional challenge, the legislature certainly has the ability to change the law before that happens, but the role of the court is to determine ultimately whether a statute is constitutional or unconstitutional. And so members, right now we've got a lot of stuff going on of a lot of people saying this is subject to challenge. Every single statute we pass every single day is subject to challenge on a constitutional basis. Every single one of them. Now, I don't know how many constitutional lawyers actually serve in the Minnesota House of Representatives, but it is improper for the legislature and individual legislators every day to stand up and say, I believe that that is unconstitutional, because that is not our role. It is the role of the court to say whether or not a statute is unconstitutional. Now, we might have our opinion. We might actually consult some others, and they might have an opinion on whether or not something is unconstitutional or not. But I believe that it is the role of the court to do that. And so at this point, I'm not with you on this bill. I think that whether or not items need to be changed at the IRRRB, that's something we'll debate. But I think coming in saying you have a constitutional problem without one person challenging it in court is a bit of a stretch.
Madam Chair, just to read from our report on page 61, we understand that courts decide constitutional questions. We understand that. But we were asked by legislators to make an analysis and assessment, not as to whether or not the current governance structure of the IRRRB is unconstitutional, but whether it is subject to a challenge, whether it's vulnerable. And what I would suggest is, if you haven't had a chance already, that you read our analysis.
I have.
People can certainly differ with it. We again quote the language of the Constitution, the Constitutional Convention, an opinion from an Attorney General. So that's what was available to us. We also consulted with a number of leading scholars at the University of Minnesota on the Minnesota Constitution. And so we didn't do this lightly, but we were asked to do it. And I think that the substance of our analysis is there for you to assess.
Any other member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this provision? Please come forward. Go ahead and state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Just a real quick comment that, based on the last couple comments that I heard. Constitutionality has always been a question at the legislative committee process. As someone who's heard thousands of hours over almost four decades now of laws and stuff, constitutionality has always been an issue. And it's one that I think should be considered. But it's one of those things, not here, but I'm just saying, I think it's always a legitimate issue to discuss those kinds of things as a bill goes forward, because you learn things and people see court decisions. Madam Chair, my specific comments here are on the issue of data practices. And I have some concerns that the bill before you may get into the little thing. Oh, the Legislative Commission is under the legislature, therefore, if someone makes a data request, we're not going to give you the information, because we, the Legislative Commission on IRRB, are not under data practices, while at the same time, under current law, as a state agency, they are. So the concern is, if now you're taking a function out of what's happening here, and particularly on, basically it starts on page 8, lines 8 through 28, 26, goes on through page 9. And if you look at some of the words, for example, the Legislative Citizen Commission shall evaluate budget proposals submitted, make recommendations. You can go on through here. There are key words that are action. So where the Legislative Commission is going to be collecting, maintaining information that it originally will be creating through its staff of LCC, which may be separate from the state agency itself. Now, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the gentleman that were just speaking, Legislative Auditor Jim Nobles, him and I go a long way, along with a couple other people who have done a lot of data practices. The Legislative Auditor is a creature of the legislature. He could share with you decades ago the battles, and I think there was one or two court decisions that said, are the legislative papers under data practices, or are they not? Are they public, or are they not? So they have a little provision in there that says very specifically, in certain instances, they're under data practices. I contend to encourage that at least a simple sentence, even though there might be interpretations, yes, they're under Data Practices Act, or whatever that council may do, I've just been here a long time, that what will happen when you may not be here, and hopefully I'll not as elected, but hopefully I'm still kicking around. I don't want to say, well, 15 years ago, this was what was done or whatever. That's why some entities, when this kind of situation comes up, they just put a straight policy. If it's the intent and it's clear it's under data practices, you can make a straight sentence. For purposes of this, it's under Chapter 13. That's your choice, but I'm just giving you my own impression historically, and secondly, that I see all that those things on 8 and 9 that are created by the Legislative Commission itself, and they're internally. And if you want to know, let's say you wanted to say, The commission must evaluate budget proposals and consider factors and then do recommendations. Okay, well, can you tell me how you got to that recommendation? And they're all internal documents of the LCIIIRB. Well, I'm sorry, but we're not under data practices, and we don't have to give those to you. That's what I'm just trying to avoid. If there's transparency and want to make it more transparent, let's do it. And I'll just say, Madam Chair, at the end, in a final statement. Senator Bach, several years ago, put in a little tax bill no one knew about to make a lot of stuff not available to the public with financial things. That happens. Legislators do a lot of their things. I've talked to the majority leader about that. But, Madam Chair, a person behind me, Mr. Anzell and Mary Liz Holberg, several years ago, saw that was wrong. And bipartisanly, they made that change. If this proposal is going to go forward, I think it can be done in a nonpartisan way. That, hey, let's have some transparency and just make clear it's under data practices for those elements that I've described.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister.
Thank you.
Questions for this testifier? Seeing none, Representative Hackbarth, I'll give you the final word.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill today. I think it's pretty straightforward where we have to go and the issue that the reason why we're before this committee.
Thank you. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3925 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mayor.
Are we adjourned?